Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
There's two Tony Sopranos. You've never seen the other one. That's the one I want to show to you.
Well, we start today acknowledging the sad news that New Jersey's own James Gandolfini has passed away. And though he had a long career in movies such as True Romance and Zero Dark Thirty, there's no question that his best-known role was obviously the mob boss, Tony Soprano. Oddly enough, that character has parallels to another iconic crime boss, the real-life criminal James Whitey Bulger. After spending 17 years on the FBI's most wanted list, you probably know he's currently on trial for 19 murders and a slew of other charges related to organized crime. Seth Stevenson is our first guest today. He grew up in Boston during Bulger's reign as one of the city's top bosses, and he's been covering the ongoing trial over at Slate, where he is a contributor. Hi, Seth. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me on.
So we talk sometimes about life imitating art, imitating life. Why are we so fascinated by these larger-than-life characters in organized crime, whether they're on TV dramas or in the news?
Well, I think gangsters, there's something about gangsters that's always fascinating. So we can go back to Robin Hood. We can, you know, go back to Dillinger and Capone and Bonnie and Clyde. We have a fascination with people who transgress. And, you know, even when it's just true crime, something like a Jeffrey Dahmer, where the guy's just a total loon, there's nothing really to dig into psychologically, people are fascinated by the gory details. But then when we talk about someone where there's a psychological dimension, and that's where Tony Soprano, you know, we like to think about these guys and what they're thinking and who they are. And we like to glorify them to some extent. And that's what I think happened with Whitey Bulger in Boston. People made him out to be this Robin Hood character who's protecting South Boston. Southie was his place, and he wasn't going to let anything bad happen to you, and he might steal money from some people, but he was your guy, and people love to think about him that way.
And you and I were just talking off the air before we started about the outpouring of emotion for James Gandolfini and how it seems to both of us like it's really an outpouring of emotion for Tony Soprano, the character, maybe even more than the actor. Not that people can't separate the two, but that's the beloved figure within James Gandolfini.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a reason why people watch The Sopranos. And yes, we like to see people get whacked and people get annoyed when there weren't enough whackings. But it was that psychological dimension. It was trying to get inside the head of a killer, trying to get inside the head of someone who does terrible things, but maybe also has some sort of human qualities to him.
And the character of Tony Soprano is usually described as an anti-hero, in that he does reprehensible things, but the viewers can't help but root for him. Do you think Whitey Bulger gets a similar treatment in real life?
I think he does. There's a reason why there have been so many books written about Whitey Bulger, why various Hollywood players are trying to make movies about him now. I mean, this is a horrible guy. This is a guy who extorted people for years, threatened them, terrified them for money, cold-blooded killer. And yet, you know, you go to the media room at the courthouse in Boston and it's filled with reporters who are following his every move. There's no news value here. These murders happened decades ago. They have no wider impact on the world. We're there for entertainment's sake. We're there to get inside the head of this horrible man.
Listeners, do you resonate? Does this resonate with you? Have you ever found yourself rooting for a mobster in fiction or in real life? Anybody from the Gotti area of Queens, let's call it, who's had experience with them as maybe protectors and providers as well as killers and criminals? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Or do you look at this whole realm, even in entertainment, and think, what's wrong with people that they wind up loving a Tony Soprano or caring for him or, you know, even more grotesquely in real life for a Whitey Bulger or a Gotti? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for Seth Stevenson, who's covering that Bulger trial for Slate. And I'd like to play a clip from The Sopranos, another clip that illustrates not only the great acting of James Gandolfini, but also the type of exchange that's common in depictions of mob life, and I think reflects some of what we've been talking about.
I am offering him the same protection that I would offer any of you in similar circumstances. I don't know what you're going to say. You're going to say, hey, don't. I would never do what he did. God bless. I hope not. But we are a family. And even in this f***ed up day and age, that means something. So we're going to deal with this as a family, together. No matter how it affects anybody, personal safety-wise, financially-wise, whatever.
So there's this idea of a separate moral code, but a moral code in the world of organized crime, at least in fiction. But I get the sense, and I'm really unfamiliar with the Bulger story, except what I've been reading, you know, these last days. But I get the feeling there is this echo in real life in the Whitey Bulger case.
There is a code to some extent. For instance, I mean, Whitey Bulger is in a lot of trouble with this trial. There's a lot of evidence stacked up against him. And in his defense attorney's opening statement, he didn't even refute. I mean, the prosecution had gone through these 19 murders. The defense attorney comes up to do his opening statement in response, and he barely refutes most of the murders. However, he did want to make clear that Whitey Bulger did not kill the women he's accused of. It's very important for Whitey Bulger to get across he didn't kill women. And the other thing that the defense attorney made clear is that Whitey Bulger is not an informant. He's not a rat. Now, that has almost zero bearing on his guilt or innocence. It doesn't really matter in the trial, but that's something Whitey Bulger really wants to get across now that he has his day in court. He is not a rat. He's not an informant.
Because that's important to who?
It's important to him. And you know, the reasoning that his lawyer gave in that opening statement was he can't possibly be a rat because he is of Irish descent. And if you're of Irish descent, the worst possible thing you can be is an informant because of the history of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And this is a big deal. And he would never be an informant because of that background.
So he's concerned about his image, not just whether he's found guilty or innocent of 19 murders. I mean, it seems almost like Bulger thought he was living on TV, considering how carefully he tried to curate this image as a Robin Hood-like figure.
He's hugely concerned about his image. And, you know, back in his days when he was still committing crimes, there was this sense in Southie that, oh, he's going to keep drugs out of Southie. Maybe this is a guy who runs some gambling rackets. Maybe he's going to do this. But he's going to keep drugs out of Southie, or he's going to protect people in Southie. Obviously, none of that was true. He was actually helping to run a cocaine ring, as far as we can tell. These codes, sometimes there can be a little bit of self-delusion going on when gangsters have these codes.
Let's take a call. Alexander in Jersey City. You're on WNYC. Hi, Alexander.
Good morning. Great to be on the show, and a longtime admirer of the show. So great topic today. I was born in New York, but I grew up at the Jersey Shore.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in a seafood restaurant for many, many years. And every summer, we would have, there was no way to confirm it, but everyone knew that we would have members of organized crime among our clients. And they would come down, usually in big families, 10, 12, 15 people. And I remember all throughout high school, college, grad school, I worked at this summer place. And I was a pretty decent waiter, and I would be assigned to look after these families for the duration of their stay in the restaurant, some cases all night.
So what'd you learn about them? Did they split the check, or, you know, what'd you learn?
I learned a bunch of different things. I mean, we obviously knew, everyone knew that these were mobsters. Growing up, partially in New York and then in Jersey during the 70s and 80s, this was the mob era, and they were mob hits in the town I grew up in. And so on the one hand, I always knew that these were not morally, people who are morally compatible to the rest of us, so to speak. You know, these are not people who live within the confines of the law. But at the same time, I had this odd feeling of, that they were taking care of their family. I mean, I'm not saying these were great fathers, so to speak, but looking at how the family structures were, there would be at least, two or three generations, grandparents, parents, and kids, maybe even more, aunts and uncles.
So the tight-knit family, and you mean family in any sense of that word. So, Alexander, thank you very much. I think you captured some of the dichotomy. Jonathan in Roselle Park.
At least, two or three
Jonathan, turn your radio off, okay? Jonathan, you're on the air. Are you there? Jonathan, do we have you? All right. We'll come back to Jonathan. Donna on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Donna.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
So, yeah, the only thing I had to say is I never quite could understand the whole romanticization of the mob in movies and TV shows, because I was exposed in real life when I lived in the city around certain areas. People I knew had connections, and I just thought they were pretty abhorrent people. Just a little guttural, you know, just not, like, lacking a conscience, that's for sure. Like, a little psychopathic, you know. And there's very few movies that deal with it on a realistic nature, like Donnie Brasco or movies like that. But most of the time, they really glorify. And I don't know if people like violence or what, but I just never got into it. I could never watch The Sopranos. I tried, but couldn't do it.
Donna, thank you. And, you know, there were movies, obviously, that glorified gangsters in the past, or at least that focused on them as somewhat, you know, somewhat sympathetic characters. I don't know, Goodfellas. I don't know if Godfather counts.
To some extent,
take
sure.
your pick. Casino, but was something different about Tony Soprano culturally as a character, as in the way that, I mean, you know, none of them went to shrinks before, but what else?
Well, the fact that this is a television show, not a movie, so we get to spend week after week after week with this guy instead of, you know, a two-hour block. He's in our homes, you know, coming into our homes week after week, and we feel like we know him after so many seasons and so many episodes of it. So I think that makes a difference. And, you know, what the caller was saying about feeling this guilt or just, you know, not understanding the appeal. As I've sat in the courthouse, I felt this guilt that I'm covering, that I'm publicizing this trial, and there are the victims' families sitting in the courtroom every day. And for those people, this isn't entertainment. You know, this isn't something that to be fascinated by. This is about justice and vengeance and about something terrible that happened to someone they loved.
And to the idea of family, it doesn't matter if this guy loved his kids.
No, I think there are very few pure evil people. I mean, I think there are dimensions to everyone. Although I would say John Martirano, the murderer of 20, who was on the witness stand this week in the Whitey Bulger trial, that guy, based on his testimony, I'm not seeing a lot of humanity there. This is a man who killed friends, looked them in the eye, shot them in the head. Just an awful, awful guy.
John in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So you grew up during the Gotti era?
I grew up in Ozone Park in the Gotti era.
And?
Well, you know, everyone in the neighborhood sort of viewed him as this, Robin Hood guy, as you're describing this morning. I remember every 4th of July he used to throw a big picnic that stretched about 5 blocks long on 101st Avenue, which is kind of the main strip here in Ozone Park.
Yep.
And every year, well, towards the end there, he would face off with Giuliani, who was mayor at the time, over illegal fireworks. And everyone in the neighborhood was clearly on Gotti's side. One of the things that most people in the neighborhood don't realize, though, was that this barbecue would be paid for with money that he would shake down the merchants for. He would go along another one of the commercial strips and kind of tell these guys, well, you know, here's the fund for the barbecue, and if you can contribute, that would be great. But if not, it would be terrible if your front window was broken.
Your tax dollars at work.
Right.
John, thank you very much. Let's see if we can get Jonathan in Roselle Park. Can I go to line 6, or is that not working? Jonathan, I think we have you now. Hi.
Yes.
So you called in to say that you're Colombian-American. You feel this goes on in Colombian culture, too?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, to this day, Pablo Escobar in the city he was from, he's considered a god. I mean, he's like, I think he's a saint. And he did more damage than he did good, easily, you know. And to this day, people pray to him sometimes, still, where he's buried at. And as a Colombian-American, I always argue with people, like, you know, why do you guys make this guy look like a hero? He was horrible.
Jonathan, thank you. There is a racial component to this that we've talked about on the show before. In America, we can make a Tony Soprano into a sympathetic figure. We're not going to do it with the Bloods or the Crips.
Probably not. And with Whitey Bulger, you know, again, it's that there's an ethnic component to it where it's very tied up in Boston Irish sort of cloistered. We're all together in this. And Whitey, you know, one of the first things he did where he was sort of getting online was when the busing, the forced busing started in Boston. He's very much opposed. And he, in fact, firebombed JFK's birthplace in Brookline, Massachusetts as a protest against forced busing. And he tried to detonate Plymouth Rock as a protest against forced busing. And the fact that you know, we're Irish, we're in Southie together, and no one else can come in here, that there's this ethnic component of that family thing again.
And on this point, I think, Lamar in Bed-Stuy, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lamar.
Hi, Brian. Great show. Yeah, you exactly said what happened to what I was saying, because I always look at kind of Omar from The Wire or some of the characters from The Wire as sympathetic figures, along with other, you know, black gangsters like Frank Lucas, Nicky Barnes, Frank Matthews, who's disappeared with $15 million. And from what I've read, they're pretty revered in the black community, kind of on the same level as Tony Soprano. But in terms of popular discourse, we always look at it as a social problem that those other people doing this, and it's not as romanticized as the mafia. And I never understood why, because at the end of the day, they're doing the same thing. I mean, they're killing people, extorting people, destroying communities. But at the same time, one is really romanticized in TV and theater, and the other one is looked at as being very dark and very evil, even though they were looked upon in the communities that they came from as being very, you know, like saving the community, you know, taking it to the white mafia, you know, trying to control the communities. A lot of that black kind of nationalism was definitely in vogue in a lot of that gangster culture, from what I understand or from what I read. I didn't grow up there or anything like that or experience any of it, but I always just see that when we talk about Tony Soprano.
It's a real dichotomy. It is interesting that the arguably two best TV drama series ever both had these criminal elements, you know, for people who think The Sopranos and The Wire are it. But any thought on that, Seth? And we're going to be out of time here in a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing about Whitey Bulger is this fascination with criminals. It's so pervasive that. But one of the interesting things about Whitey Bulger is that he had a man on the inside in the FBI. That's part of why he got away with his crimes for so long. Is he had a man on the inside who was helping him out. And why was this guy helping him out? Because he just thought he was cool. He grew up in Southie, and he thought Whitey Bulger was this cool gangster who he was in awe of. And so when he joined the Boston Bureau of the FBI, he helped Whitey Bulger out. He tipped him off. He let him get away with things.
And I gather that there are two Bulger movies in the works.
At least two, I think. Robert Duvall apparently was trying to get into the courthouse recently. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, I'm sure, have designs on this.
And even considering The Sopranos, Bulger's life and criminal career prove that the truth can be stranger than fiction. After 17 years in hiding, Bulger was found in Santa Monica thanks to a tip from a former Miss Iceland. He was once part of a plot to take over the World High Life Association in the 80s, which they say led to a murder. He won a $14 million lottery in Boston, widely believed to have been rigged.
Somebody else won that lottery, and Whitey came up to that guy and said, guess what? We won that lottery together.
But if David Chase were to receive these storylines from a writer, he might reject them as too far-fetched.
Oh, Whitey's as colorful as it gets. I mean, you hate to, again, here we are glorifying, but he's as colorful as it gets. I mean, the guy sent a small fishing boat full of munitions across the Atlantic Ocean to try to arm the IRA, which did not work. And you're right. I mean, he killed a legitimate businessman in Tulsa, Oklahoma as part of a plot to take over the World High Life Association. You really can't make this stuff up.
And he's not even wearing suits in court.
Oh, no. Blue jeans, tucked in long sleeve shirts.
Seth Stevenson grew up in Boston during Whitey Bulger's reign as one of the city's top bosses. He's been covering the ongoing trial at Slate. Thanks for coming in, Seth.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we have a special guest, Michael Mulgrew, president of the United Federation of Teachers. He'll tell us why the union endorsed Bill Thompson for mayor yesterday, and he will argue that the teachers' union agenda is in everyone's interest. Stay with us.